There we go. I'm always supposed to do this big pause. And so let's start. Let's jump into the questions and comments. Some of these are actually offerings, and then talk about whatever you guys want to talk about. So here's a sweet little comment from Joe. This is a sharing. I have a large table top prayer wheel with Om Mani Padme Hum mantras inside. I do too, right here. But my batteries run out. This is my little, I have to put a new battery in it. Basically, this is my battery operated automatic prayer wheel. And so when the batteries are there, in fact, this reminds me to recharge it. This sweet little thing that I can't remember if somebody gave it to me is constantly spinning and sending out blessings and merit. And so I have one of those too. I just need to put the battery back in. Whenever I talk to a customer service person on the phone at the end of the call, I thank them for their help and tell them that I'm going to spin the prayer wheel for them and it will send them lots of positive energy. Of course, I just say it has prayers inside and never mention the prayers of Buddhist. The response is very positive, even though they probably have no idea what a prayer wheel is. LOL. That's great, Joe. Fantastic. Good for you. I love it. Hey, doesn't hurt, you know? Prayer wheels, prayer flags, I mean, whatever. Fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. Okay. Here's one from Tim. It's difficult for me to meditate in the seated position for more than 20 minutes. Okay. I start to get a lot of tension and pain in my lower back. You're not the only one. Lying down and meditating helps relieve this. Excellent. Do you recommend lying down on your belly, on my belly or my back for optimal results? Definitely on your back. You don't want to lie down on your belly. Now, that doesn't mean you can't meditate lying down on your belly. I mean, the whole point really, Tim, is to be able to meditate under any position, really. But classically in the Satipatthana Sutra, the classic treatise on meditation, they have four so-called sanctioned postures, sitting, standing, lying down, and walking. And just lying down is fantastic. When B. Allen Wallace, my friend, does his big long 3-month shamatha meditation things, he does most of these, my understanding, I've never attended them, but people who have told me, he invites his people to lie down and do their shamatha. So that's great. That's great. If you could summarize the most important teachings from my life's work. Whoa, Tim, you think I'm dying or something? I could summarize the most important teachings from my life's work into one quintessential teaching. What would it be? Oh, I like this. I used to ask this question actually to a bunch of different people. Like, you know, I used to put it this way. If you realize at this moment, in fact, I think I did this a couple of times with some of my interview guests. If you realize you only had a minute left to live, what would be the irreducible essence of your instruction? I like that because I tend to remember it. So here you go, Tam, write it down. Ready? Open and relax. That's it. Done deal. Open, relax. That's all you have to do. You don't need the path. You don't need the teachings. You don't need anything else. You just need to open, relax, done deal. Okay. But I always say this tongue in cheek, whenever I make this kind of irreducible instruction, usually somebody raises their hand and says, yes, 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 but I call it the big but. So if it's yes and they say, but, then I say, okay, we've got this thing called the path. You don't need the path. It's like T.S. Eliot, you know, to return as from where you started and see it as if for the first time. It's a path to nowhere or to now here. You don't need a spiritual path. You really don't. Trust me on this. So Tim, just for you, open, relax, hard stop, done deal. That's it. You don't need to attend these programs anymore. You don't have to spend any more money on books or teachings. Open, relax. You'll put every spiritual teacher out of business. And by the way, I don't consider myself that. When people write up or they talk to me about is like being a spiritual teacher, it kind of gives me the creeps, actually. Oy, spiritual teacher, yikes. No, at best, I'm what's called a Kalyana Mitra. I'm a spiritual friend, just a nerd who's just maybe read a couple more things or been meditating a little bit longer. I am not a spiritual teacher because I think I've been sharing with you people, right? At least I mentioned it the other day. The two biggest things, I wrote a brief article It'll be published in one of the magazines coming up. I don't know which one yet. The two biggest problems with the spiritual path, right? Remember this? Number one, the use of the word spiritual. Horrible, horrible. Spiritual, not merely in contradistinction to material, but in opposition to it. That leads to a ton of spiritual bypassing issues. So the two biggest things with the spiritual path, two biggest problems. One is the use of the word spiritual. Two is the use of the word path. Outside of that, the spiritual path is perfect. But spiritual path needs major rebranding, because it's spiritual. That means, okay, that means I have to go somewhere. That's where the path comes in. A path to where? No, it's a path to here, now, nowhere. So spiritual path is like this, it's bad business. It's bad branding. So anyway, open and relax, Tim, that's all you got to do. Okay, from Vlad, how can I practice the Bardo, I guess you mean Bardo teachings, and help my parents to transition when the time comes? Really great question, Vlad. Well, let's start with what you can do for yourself. Working with the Bardo teachings, the gap teachings, the teachings on death and dying from the Tibetan perspective is a monumental way to understand the nature of the journey, to understand the nature of your mind and heart, and to get a really, really profound doctrinal and an experiential understanding and then realization of what actually happens according to the Tibetan view, which makes so much sense to me, of what happens when you die. And so here's the amazing thing with this, Vlad, is when you do that, if you do that with some rigor and you really work with these teachings, you will discover a couple of really interesting things. And first of all, your aspiration is really beautiful. It's really laudable to practice the teachings for the benefit of others. That's maybe that, Tim, that might be the third thing, bodhicitta, right? So, okay, three things, right? Open, relax. That means open your heart, do what you're doing for the benefit of others. So that's the third thing, Tim. But one of the best things we can do is work on our stuff with the aspiration to be of benefit to others. And so you will discover, Vlad, that when you do this, one of the things you'll notice is that while the storylines of your parents are obviously different from yours, the storylines of every sentient being on this planet are different from yours, the essence of the mind and the heart are the same. It's the same. We all share the same essential mind and heart. And so by understanding your mind and heart, well, guess what happens? You will understand the foundational essential mind and heart of your parents or anybody else. And then what happens here is actually quite magical, because then what happens is with this understanding and the confidence born from it, I speak from direct experience, because I did the same thing with my parents and others. When you are around them in the process of death and dying or even previously, it's kind of magical. You will almost automatically know what to do, that you don't have to come into an environment with a preset set of criteria and doctrines, even though there are some tips of like sacred listening and things that can really help. But if you really understand the nature of your mind and heart, then you will understand the nature and the mind and heart of everybody. And then you will know exactly what to do. You will understand what the other person is going through. And therefore you will act from that kind of commonality of the human condition. So with that said as an overarching view, some practical tips would be to come in, I suggested briefly, through the Bardo teachings, as an exquisitely sensitive listener. Don't come in with a bowling ball set of criteria. Oh, I've got to do this. I got to make sure they have a good death. No. If you really kind of open your heart, silence, they will tell you in a certain way. The environment will tell you what to do. If you're simply a good listener, the environment will dictate what needs to take place. And therefore, and I notice this really with everybody. Sometimes it's quite overt, sometimes it's quite subtle. But if you're really open and relaxed, somewhat connected back to Tim's question, the environment will always show you, teach you what to do. It's really quite magical. It's really quite beautiful in that regard. So those are the two things that come to mind. Specifically, Vlad, if you want to learn more about this, my book, it's all about me. My book, Preparing to Die, has a ton on this. What to do for yourself and for others from a spiritual and practical point of view before, during, and after death. It's as comprehensive as I can get. And so I approach your question from those aspects with exhaustion in this big book I wrote maybe some 7-8 years ago. So if you want to learn more about the details, a little bit more about sacred listening, a little bit more about the techniques, about specific practical things you can do, creating proper holding environments, more esoteric things like sur offerings, all kinds of really, I think, quite remarkable things, then that might be a source that could be of some interest to you. Okay. All right. So here I am. I'm like a stockbroker. I got all these computers around me, so I'm reading off my other computer. Okay, so here's one from Katie. Katie always has such really lovely questions, as do many people, but these are great. Okay, so I'll read the second one first. In the interview with Tenzin Wangyal, interviewed Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche a couple of weeks ago. So that's on the Edge of Mind podcast. He said, if you don't have a subtle body, then you're stuck in this physical world. Did he mean literally that it is possible not to have a subtle body? No, it's not. Everybody has a subtle body. Or did he mean that if one does not develop one's subtle body through the inner yogas, one will not be able to use it? Yeah, it's more like that. That if you don't really cultivate your understanding, your relationship, your experience of the subtle body, that you have this more interiority. By the way, Katie, this ties into your first question about the Sambhogakaya. Sambhogakaya, I'll get to that overtly in just a second, but Sambhogakaya is definitely connected to subtle body. So both these questions are related to each other. So if you don't have a relationship to the subtle body, which most of us don't, and that's just one of three bodies, right? At least in the Buddhist tradition, we have what's called the Trikaya, three bodies, the outer physical body, the Nirmanakaya is just the gross physical body. Within that, you have the Sambhogakaya, subtle body. Within that, you have the Dharmakaya, the extremely subtle body. And so it's not so much if you don't have a subtle body, it is if you don't relate to that subtle body, then what happens? You're exclusively identified with the outer physical, Nirmanakaya, the physical body, and the physical world, because you think that's all there is. That's actually what ego is, exclusive identification with physicality or form. And so if you don't have a relationship to that, then what? You're frozen, you're stuck in samsara. You're stuck in materialism, you're stuck in exteriority, you have no interoceptive interest or faculties, you're not interested in inner work, you're just the archetype would be people obsessed with money, materialism, fame, power, because you think the physical and material is all there is, right? And so this is why I talk about this identity theft that occurs constantly in broad daylight. Every time we identify with exteriority, with gross subtle body, you're stuck in physical form, you're going to suffer. Why? Because that's not who you really are. It's only 1/3 of who you are. And your degree of relationship or identification with that physical exterior is directly proportionate to how much you're going to suffer when you age, get sick, and die. Because when you get old and sick and die, if you only identify with the part that does get old, sick, and die, which is your outer body, brace yourself, Bridget. You're in for a really rough ride. But if you realize that's not who I am, that's just like my suntan fading. That's just old costumes, clothes being worn out. Then old age, sickness, and death has no impact on you because that's not who you really are. Okay? And so your first question, this is a great question. Could you please explain from my own experience, my understanding and experience, what is the Sambhogakaya? Yeah, this is really nice. So briefly, Sambhogakaya, Sambhogakaya, Sambhogakaya. It's interesting, Sanskrit is so much like baby language, right? Sambhogakaya. This is part of what's called the Trikaya doctrine that I mentioned earlier. Trikaya, three bodies. This is a really big topic. It comes from the Sarvastivadin tradition in Buddhism. That originally, specifically, Katie, as you probably know, specifically talked about the three bodies of the historical Buddha, the outer gross body, Nirmanakaya, purified subtle inner body, Sambhogakaya, pure formless body within that, Dharmakaya. And so those three bodies eventually, really, they were extrapolated because they had so much explanatory power They were extrapolated to talk about the three dimensions of reality: gross, subtle, and very subtle. And even from there, like a fractal, there was so much power to describing anything in the phenomenal world using this kind of tripartite system. So there's so much to say here, but in the briefest way, and then I'm going to actually share a reading from my dear friend Francesca, who I think just nails this, is that the first body, so to speak, provisionally, the Dharmakaya, body of truth, body of reality, you can think of it this way. That's, and you'll see how this ties in. That's complete formlessness, emptiness associated with space. On the other end is the Nirmanakaya. If you're looking at a spectrum, that's fully reified, solidified form, matter, physicality, or what we perceive as physicality. So on one level, those are pretty easy. Formlessness, form. Sambhogakaya, to me, is the most interesting one because it's this vast intermediate bandwidth of everything from fully manifest form to fully de-reified formlessness. And that's why the Sambhogakaya is not so easy initially to understand, because there's just so much going on here. In Shambhala language, it's called beautifully the inner court. And the inner court is the most populated of all the courts. And so, oh my gosh, so much to say here. So I'm saying this because when I talk about my personal experience of it, it'll make more sense. The Sambhogakaya, at its earliest inception in the Bardo teachings, right? This is where all the deities appear. So the experience of the Dharmakaya or Sambhogakaya here is experiencing deity principle in your experience and in life, which is where everything appears as basically fundamentally a body of light. So this is deeply connected, Katie, to pure and perfectly pure illusory form. It's the same thing that I talk about in Dreams of Light. So the Sambhogakaya runs from the very first instantiation of any level of form, sound and light, literally in the physical world, what we know as form. Light has a certain form, but it's mostly formless. Sound, my voice, has a certain form, but it's mostly formless. So it runs from that first instantiation of form, which takes place in phase one, part one of phase two of the luminous Bardo Dharmata, all the way to the full reification of that light into physicality. So again, there's so much to say here. This is one of the biggest doctrines in both Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhism. But I wanted to share a really beautiful quote from my dear friend Francesca Fremantle on this, where she really riffs on it. And if you want to really explore this, Katie, I recommend her book, Luminous Emptiness, Exploring, Understanding the Tibetan Book of the Dead. She has a really beautiful chapter called The Threefold Pattern of the Path, where she talks about this really, really in a beautiful way. And she starts with this wonderful statement from William Blake, right? The Sambhogakaya is energy in eternal delight. And so basically when you're talking about Sambhogakaya, you're talking about the domain of communication, which is why the Sambhogakaya chakra is what? Throat chakra. This is also what? Connected to the dreams, because the dreams, when purified, they're Sambhogakaya, right? So here's what she says that is just really beautiful. The experience of the Sambhogakaya, and I read this when I read this decades ago, not decades, I guess this book's been out 15 years. I said, high five, this is really great. The experience of the Sambhogakaya is to perceive the world directly and nakedly, welcoming whatever appears with or without preconceptions. It's fantastic. I mean, what a great thing. Very practical. First thought, best thought. To see the world actually without thought. This is what it means to see the world purely before the imputation of concept, before hopes and fears, aspirations, and everything else. To see the world purely. Sense perceptions become clear, sharp, more colorful. The nature of the five Buddhas, and so I can't explain all these terms, but the nature of the five Buddhas spontaneously reveals itself in flashes of insight. And one sees intuitively how the whole of existence is pervaded by the qualities of the energies of the five families. So what she's talking about here is that, again, there's so much here. When the pure light of the Dharmakaya, think metaphorically here, in the Bardo teachings, this is really powerful. When the pure light of the Dharmakaya connected to the Ein Sof in Jewish mysticism, very, very, very similar. When that pure white light is refracted through the prism of fundamentally prison of ignorance, that white light refracts into five primordial colors. We know this even neurologically, right? Perceptually. Each one of those five particular primary colors, that becomes the seed color then for what? The five Buddha families, of which they're called families because everything in manifest reality is an expression, an iteration, or belongs to one of these families. And so this is exactly what she's talking about here. And so again, it's this energetic communicative display that in a very real way connects form and emptiness, connects the Nirmanakaya with the Dharmakaya. So back to her, this is great. The world is then recognized as sacred, magical, and full of wonder. It becomes a boundless source of life and goodness. This is really beautiful. So when you're walking in nature, this is the way I really connect to it, and something completely stops your mind, the majesty of a sunset, of a mountain, of a river, often nature will do this. And you're perceiving the world without concept, the world just seems brighter, more alive, vibrant, clear, sacred. That's the Bodhikaya. It contains all the vitality and passion for the emotions, free from the confusion that brings misery and pain. There's a sense of fearlessness and play and continual discovery, an invitation to take part in the dance of life. So there's more to say on that, but I thought that's pretty good. Francesca's really got a solid beat on that. So if you want to come on and bat this around a little bit more than welcome to do that. But it's a really wonderful question, because sometimes these things like the deity, right? What does it mean to experience the deity? Well, this is deeply connected. Our emotions, when they're purified, right? So this is another way to experience Sambhogakaya. When our emotions are related to purely, without reference to self, without reference to energy, I'm sorry, without reference to other, that emotion is experienced as pure energy. It's just raw, pure energy. And that's what it really actually means to meet the deity. And so you want to experience the Sambhogakaya, experience your anger purely, without reference to self and other. You will find it becomes clear, vibrant, sacred, and manifests then as the Vajra family, right? The wisdom of Akshobhya. So your anger manifests as Akshobhya. That's the experience of the Sambhogakaya and anger. Same thing happens with passion. You experience that purely, that transforms into the warmth of compassion. That's Amitabha. Same thing with envy, jealousy. When that experience purely as Sambhogakaya, that's Amoghasiddhi. When you experience pride purely, that's Ratnasambhava. And so all the emotions, when they're related to in this pure non-referential way, that's principally the way to experience it. Without reference to self, that right there becomes the Sambhogakaya. Or is recognized as the Sambhogakaya. So therefore, what this intimates is that before you stain it with referentiality, with contraction onto self, everything that arises is fundamentally pure in this regard. And so, yeah, there's lots more to say on this, but maybe that's enough for people who aren't Buddhists. It's like, what the heck is this guy talking about? But that's a really great question, and hopefully that's of some interest. Okay, let me see if I missed anything here. Oh yeah, one more from Tim. I'm very sincerely trying to work deeper and deeper with dream yoga as a path. Very cool. As I'm doing that, I'm becoming more and more aware of that autonomous force that seems to oppose or block us in our endeavors. Ah, Tim, I'm going to call you on your crap here, my friend. There's several times over questions in the past, and I love your questions, where again, because I'm trying to help you a little bit, you and many of us seems to have this reifying tendency. I've noticed this in some of your questions. We all do it. That there seems to be, as you put it, there's an autonomous force that somehow seems, you know, this agency somehow seems external, dark force or whatever that somehow has challenged you. No. It's not that. There is no autonomous, dark, demonic force out there like Satan or the devil. It just doesn't really work that way. In dreams, I notice it occasionally taking the form of adversarial characters. Well, is it? No, that force is basically ignorance, maripa. That's what actually creates, or I should say, imputes the reified nature of the so-called force. It's just ignorance, not knowing. There's no external agentic, demonic, satanic force out there working against you. No. In dreams, I notice it occasionally taking the form of adversarial characters. Yes, sometimes it can become anthropomorphized that way, or obstacles and blocks and limitations of various kinds. But again, it's not solid, man. One of the best ways to deal with this thing right off the bat, Tim, and this relates to your earlier question. You asked me about the irreducibility, open and relax. Well, if you open and relax, you're going to de-reify this. You're going to pull the rug out from under this force. This force only has as much power or force as you impute upon it. And this is what happens all the time. We do it all the time. This is why it's such a great question. We're always giving our power away by reifying externality. And in so doing, basically, we're controlled in direct proportion to how we give away our force, our own power, freezing it in seemingly external agencies. That's not the nature of reality. If you open, you're going to de-reify this force. You're going to see it for what it is, particular level of confusion. That's all it is, just a particular level of confusion. And that right there softens it, makes it much more workable. Because otherwise, you're setting up an adversarial relationship with an illusion, with a projection. That's not going to help you, man. You want to de-reify, not reify. Obviously, I do not knowingly, consciously create this force. That's true, you don't. These are the forces of the dark side, the forces of habitual patterns of ignorance and not knowing. We all have it. I do not knowingly, consciously create this force or principle in my dreams or waking life, but there it is anyway. Seemingly persistent on all levels. It's not an it. It's not there like waiting for you, clobbering you, right? No, it's just a projection of your own confusion into a seemingly reified external agency. In your understanding, what is that adversarial force? Confusion. Is it designed to keep us from waking up? No, it's not. It's designed by ego. It's not designed by some whatever. It's just confusion. I really want to understand this. Hopefully what I said is helpful. Appreciate blah, blah, blah. So Tim, if you're on and want to follow up on this, happy to run with it a little bit. But I think that's the most important thing tied to your earlier question is just stay open. Don't reify. Be curious. Investigate. Penetrate through the illusion. It may seem solid. It may seem forceful. It may seem agentic. But if you take a really close look at this, looking itself starts to melt it because the looking itself is awareness. And nothing can really stand the light of awareness. It'll melt, just like the Wicked Witch of the West. So you're basically creating, we all do it, a Wicked Witch of the West. You're generating it out there. You can melt it. Just look at it very closely, establish a relationship to it, see through it, melt it. And guess what happens? It basically liberates an energy. It liberates into what we were talking about earlier with Katie's question, this just purified energetic, right? So, that's what comes to mind, my friend. Good stuff. I really appreciate it. Okay. So let me see if some questions came in here, and then let me get to EKP0506. I heard somewhere that Elon Musk didn't, I read somewhere, tell me if I'm wrong, that Elon Musk actually has like numbers for his kids. Is that true? I heard that somewhere. His kids actually don't have names. They have like serial numbers or something. I don't know if that's true, but I thought I read that somewhere. So anyway, fire away while I go through the Q&A and the chat.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, this is my work account and I don't know why it shows up that way. I keep trying to change it. I'm rereading, or I pulled back out this Awakening the Luminous Mind by Rinpoche that you just interviewed.
Oh yeah, Tungsten Wangyal is great. Yeah, he's a sweetheart.
Yeah, and it's a little difficult, but some of the words you use today, I struggle with these a little bit. Formlessness, spaciousness, clear light, boundless, luminosity. I find that, so he walks you through a meditation where first you picture something, you realize your mind is empty. That goes okay. And then it's, you realize that the pictures in your mind are being created by your mind. So mind is vision, mind is empty. Then you start to move into trying to experience clear light. and the awareness of clear light, which he calls union. Anyway, I find that whenever I think about spaciousness or boundlessness, I'm trying to picture it. So I find myself picturing a white light, you know, in the crown chakra, or picturing like stars in the universe. And I'm trying to envision boundlessness and spaciousness, but I'm not, what I'm feeling is just my physical body. So I guess I struggle with the concept of like clear light and luminosity, and I don't want to see it. I want to feel it. Does that, I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, it totally makes sense. And actually, okay. it's a really great question. So here, that stuff is so cool. These are really pretty deep questions, right? Because when you talk about clear light mind, it's another way to talk about the nature mind. It's another way to talk about the enlightened mind. It's another way to talk about emptiness, non-duality, right? So like, whoa. No wonder it's not so easy to wrap your mind around it, right? This is a really big deal topic. And so here, oh my gosh, again, like Katie's question, there's so much here. But here's perhaps the most important thing around this is there's no way you're going to be able to imagine it, visualize it, or whatever. Because no matter how big your visualization is, how refined, sophisticated, you're trying to shrink wrap infinity and eternity into a conceptual tidy packet. That ain't going to work. Yeah. So when you're talking about clear light mind, you're talking about something that's completely trans-conceptual. You literally can't know it with the conceptual logic, rational mind. They're mutually exclusive. But what you can do, which is exactly what you're doing, is walk that kind of plank through the process of hearing, listening, and contemplating. But eventually, the only way to know the clear light mind is to walk to the edge of the plank and jump. And that's through direct experience with meditation. And that's why there's the pedagogical approach of listen, contemplate, meditate. It's only through meditation that you will get the clear light mind, because it's beyond even contemplation. It's just that those are two ways to walk towards the end of the plank diving board, but then you have to jump. And then when you recognize it, in a certain way, it's difficult to even talk about, because the actual moment of recognition, you won't be there in the act of recognition. That's the kicker. And that's why, that's what makes this so interesting. When you actually try to recognize, I should say, to experience the clear light mind, ego can't attend its own funeral. You can't experience the clear light mind. The experience, the clear light mind, can only happen by itself. And so this is not like sophistry. This isn't some like Zen jujitsu. No, this is the way it is. Who you know is yourself. You literally cannot experience the clear light mind. They're mutually exclusive by definition, because you, ego, bodily encased, is just, again, a shrink wrap against this infinitude. It just doesn't work. But what we do is we understand it. We go, okay, that makes kind of sense. I can get that. And then you do the practices. You engage in the hearing, you engage in the contemplating, and then you do the meditations. And then one day you will get it. And that you will get it at the point when you dissolve. See, like when that little droplet is returned to the infinity of the ocean, then you will say, oh my God. In retrospect, you will not have this when you're in the experience. You will postscript, you'll come out of the experience, you'll retrofit. Oh my gosh, I think that was a clear light mind. But when you're in it, you're not there. Everything that's going to come afterwards will say, hey, I think that was a clear light mind. But here's the kicker, and a great place to leave it. There's nothing but the clear light mind. Let me say this like 10,000 times. There's nothing but the clear light mind. You're looking at it. Everything you're appearing, it's appearing in front of you. Everything you see, smell, hear, taste, touch, think. That's the clear light mind. There is nothing but the clear light mind. That's it. Hard stop, period. So what do you have to do to recognize it, right? Let's go back to Tim's question. Open, relax, recognize. So in a certain way, you'll never experience the clear light mind. The only thing you can do is recognize it. And when you do, you're going to be like, you'll come out of it and you'll go, holy crap, how could I have been so fooled for so long? The second thing that's going to happen is you're going to say, oh my gosh, is it really this simple? Yes, it is. And that's one reason we miss it. because we think that Clear Light Mind has to be this big cosmic spiritual orgasm or this big Hollywood production thing. We look for the extraordinary. I playfully say it's like looking for Hollywood when the experience is more like Oklahoma. I love Oklahoma. I'm not dissing Oklahoma. But it's ordinary. The mind that actually recognizes that is literally called ordinary mind in Tibetan. Tamil Gishepa is literally ordinary mind. And so this is important because we think, again, this is why I'm dissing the whole spiritual path thing. Yes, yes, on relative terms. Yes, you need the path. You accumulate merit and wisdom. I'm not criticizing that. But eventually the path itself becomes an obstacle. And so fundamentally, where is the path to nowhere? Spiritual, look at the material properly, it becomes the spiritual. Open your eyes, clear the cataracts of confusion. You realize you're in the clear light mind right here, right now, because that's all there is. And if you think about the logic here, if that's really true, there's nothing but enlightenment. There's nothing but the non-dual state. There's nothing but nirvana. There's nothing but the clear light mind. How do you recognize or attain, I just only say this, let me rephrase that. How do you attain something that you already have, that you already are? You can't. Trying to, like Trungpa Rinpoche said, striving becomes the only obstacle. You can't. And so this becomes very Zen-like, right? You got to like, you try. That's the wrestling match. That's the work. You have to go through that. But then eventually the only way to get it is you drop everything and you go, oh my God, there it is. And so guess what happens? If you don't do it now, it will happen to you, for you, when? What? When you die. Because this is exactly what's going to happen when you die. You're going to stop doing. You're going to open. It's a force, what I call the grand opening. It's the force grand opening into reality. And you're going to land, relax, drop back into the clear light mind that you've never left. It's just basically all those adventitious obfuscations, defilements are going to be gone at the moment of death, right? And that's why when all that dust is removed, you're going to say, you, there it is. It's been there all along. Well, again, you don't have to wait till you die to do that. Die before you die. Do the meditations. Do this stuff. Go into retreat. Open. Die. And boom, there it is. You're looking at it right now. I am not kidding you. This is the frozen clear light mind right now. That's all there is. If you really understand that logic, it ties in beautifully to Tim's question. The only thing you have to do is what? Open, relax, hard stop.
Yeah, and I think that's so helpful because I feel like some of the meditation teachings and instructions I've followed can become very cerebral. And you're trying so hard to follow the steps and you're not supposed to be lazy. And what's the word when you're just like, you're supposed to be focused and you're supposed to be contemplating and you're supposed to be awake. And you get tangled up in your mind again.
It absolutely ties you into knots. And so, you know, there is a place for that. They call it the 84,000 dharmas. And why did all those 84,000 dharmas come about? It's an archetypal number. Why do we have 84,000 teachings? Well, to match the complexity of the modern complex mind. Because in fact, a lot of teachers have done this. They come into the West and they do this absolute kind of Nike approach, right? Just do it. It's true. Absolutely. Open, relax, done deal. Well, get back to me in 10, 20 years and let me know how that works. It's too radical. It's too steep. In a certain way, it's too easy. And so therefore, especially the Buddhists, you know, oh my gosh, do we have the complexities, right? Oh my gosh, do we have the lists? Oh my gosh, do we have, it's like overwhelming. I mean, look at all these damn books I have behind me, right? Well, this is just a scratch and they're not all Buddhists, but there's just an incredible sophisticated array of teachings. On one level, designed to match the so-called sophistication, the complexity of the modern mind. On one level, you don't need any of this crap. And so what we do is we dance between relative and absolute truth. So I don't want to disparage the whole relative thing. I don't want to too overtly disparage the path. On one level, we do need it. But on another level, when we're talking about these absolute dimensions, that this stuff actually gets in the way. See? And so we work with both. It's very hard to rest in the nature of mind all the time because we have our patterns that aren't conducive to that. And so then when we can't do that, then we do what we're doing here. We talk about it. We read, we practice, we do whatever. So we work, in my understanding, experience is you work with relative and absolute. But all the while, the absolute is the most foundational. It out contextualizes everything, see? And so to me, this is fantastic. It's like, wow, as I playfully say, just do nothing, but do it really well. That's meditation. Just do nothing. Exactly what happens when you die. You're going to do nothing. Just do it really well. It's not easy because we're not human beings. We're human doings. But I think you get the point. Okay? Cool. Great question. All right. Let me see if something came in the chat. And then I see Kimberly here. Okay. Francesca. During the Monday meditation session, you mentioned you're doing a Bardo program in France at Dutch and Scholling. Yes, I just confirmed it. Can we have the link to register and the dates? Oh, you're so sweet. It's not up yet. Where I'm pressing them to get it up because people need to prepare. But the dates, I can give you the dates, the 20th through the 27th in Dutch and Scholling in France. So we don't have the registration page up yet. Francesca, it'll be up next week. But thank you for asking. So stay tuned. Also, you mentioned you're looking for a retreat center here in Europe to do the other programs, blah, blah, blah. Check out Mandali in Italy. Oh, nice. I'm doing a program there in June with Bob and Michelle Lowe. Oh, how wonderful. Good for you. Well, the good news there is since Monday, my wonderful trader friend actually secured a retreat center in Spain after all. Hidden Paradise, I think it's called. So we did find a location, but that's good to know. I did not know about Mandali in Italy, so I'll check that out. Okay, Barry, always the infinite resource. Thank you, Barry. Interesting article about subtle body. So here's the deal about subtle body, right? So this is so interesting. So Sambhogakaya, you can think about Sambhogakaya in connection to subtle body. So like when we talk Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nimanakaya, subtle, gross, subtle, very subtle. When we talk about both Sambhogakaya and subtle body, because it's such a large multivalent set of terms, you can talk about these both phenomenologically and anatomically. And by this, what I mean is that there is a subtle body anatomically. That's the subtle body that's connected to the channels and the winds, drops, and chakras and all that kind of thing. That's part of the subtle body. That's the anatomical subtle body. But then there's the phenomenological subtle body. That's our emotions. That's our thoughts, right? And so I tried to figure this out for the longest time. It's like, okay, this subtle body thing is like, what? So Barry, I find it also helpful connection to the Sambhogakaya because these are such large terms. You can think of them as bodies, as kayas, as subtle forms, but you can also think of them phenomenally as pure experience. See? Okay. Oh, okay, from 2020, Elon Musk and singer Grimes announced their newborn son would be named. Yeah, isn't that it? That's just great. Yeah. It's a serial number. Yeah, transhumanism, right? I can't quite wrap my mind around that whole thing. Wonder what his nickname will be. Oh, Virginia, that's awesome. Yeah, how do you put a nickname on that? That's awesome. Question, during lucid dreamless sleep, do you have any sense of your physical body? No, you don't. That's what constitutes dreamless. Dreamless means formless. So the only thing that happens in deep dreamless sleep is pure formless awareness itself. There's no sense of physicality whatsoever. So the only thing you have a sense of, first of all, there's no you. Awareness dissolves back into itself. And what is actually, if you're experiencing any so-called body, you're experiencing Dharmakaya, very subtle truth body. Okay, Tanya? So no sense of the physical body. Okay, Kimberly, fire away.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Nice to see you. So sweet.
Good. So just in regards to the question before about the clear light mind. So I would like you to tell me if my cognition is right. So what I do or what I try to do is I kind of try to reverse my cognition and think that it's the clear light mind is doing me. So in that, like when I try to understand that, I kind of, I suppose, fall off that edge of that thing that you were talking about. And just am able to sit in this kind of just witnessing kind of state, I suppose, and just seeing that everything that around me, including myself, my actions, whatever I'm doing, thinking, is all clear light mind. Would that be, does that sound like correct?
Yes, it does. But again, you know, the trick with these is what we're trying to use a dualistic medium to talk about something that's non-dualistic. That's impossible. And so, you know, language, subject, object, predicate, it's you're stuck the minute you open your mouth around these sorts of things. So I think I understand and agree with the spirit of what you're saying. The clear light mind does you. Yes, I think there's something beautiful to say about that. But I might say something more, or maybe to augment that, is that the clear light mind radiates you, manifests you, shines as you. So I think you might get the very subtle distinction there, but I think it's what you're saying, that kind of flip is a good one. That if you transfer the, you know, again, the context to the clear light mind itself, and that you then become the shine, the radiance, the play, literally the lila, the display of that clear light mind. That's it. So I'm not sure if that resonates with you, but that's what comes to mind.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And also, like, you know, in languaging, is clear light mind kind of synonymous with what we would call God?
Yeah.
And that's how I kind of see it. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, you know, it depends on how you define God, but Godhead is, you know, source of everything. Then I think you could say that. The trick there is any level of anthropomorphizing, any level of projection, imputation. But I think if it's held in its pure esoteric way within Gnosticism, for instance, I think you could carefully make that sort of definition. But this is where things get a little bit interesting, however, because, you know, there's used to be kind of the popular thing in the academy and other places, the so-called perennial philosophy, right? They're all these traditions are pointing to the same thing, right? Saying the same thing. Maybe. I mean, who am I to say? I think it sounds nice. It sounds elegant. It sounds like a big unitary sort of thing. I think in theory that sounds nice, but who knows? Who knows? I mean, who amongst us has actually walked one path to completion, let alone all the others? So I think we just have to be a little bit careful when we say, is God the same as clear light mind, as Dharmakaya, as Ein Sof, or whatever? Who knows, right? To me, it has this kind of elegance, symmetry that they would be nice if it's true, but I don't know, right? So anyway, I try to be humble around those sorts of things, because otherwise what happens is it's very easy. I always get a little, let me put it this way. I always get a little bit nervous when things become too tidy, too sorted out, too packaged. Like, oh, I've got the whole thing. I've got this thing, right? Whenever that happens, I always get a little nervous. In fact, well, let me see if I can find this. I excerpted this quote because I'm going to use it this weekend. Let me see if I can read this to you. This is so beautiful. This is important, 116. I think this is so key. Let me read this to you because this is awesome. Thich Nhat Hanh, from this beautiful book, Understanding Our Mind. This is a wonderful rendering from his perspective of the Yogacara tradition, which those of you who know me, this is such a profound teaching. And I think this is his single best book. It's his deepest book, as far as I can tell. So he writes this. This is just great. Oh, here we go. Where was the page? Yeah, here it is. According to Buddhist thought, when we know something, when we learn something, it can become an obstacle to our progress. It's literally called Jnaya Varna. There's two principal forms of affliction in Buddhism: the affliction of conflicting emotions and the affliction of knowledge. Knowledge itself becomes a problem. This is really interesting. If we cling to what we have learned as the absolute truth, we are caught by that knowledge. Acquiring knowledge is like climbing a ladder. In order to step up to a higher rung, we have to let go of the rung we are standing on. If we believe that the step we're standing on is the highest, then we can climb no higher. The technique of learning in this tradition is always to release, to let go of what we have just learned or what we have already obtained. Never believe that what you know is the absolute truth. If you are caught by the knowledge you presently possess, that is the end of your progress. Let me say that again. I have the auto sign on every one of my emails with this. If you are caught by the knowledge you presently possess, that's the end of your progress. On the path of practice, knowledge is an obstacle that must be overcome. We must be ready to abandon our knowledge at any moment in order to get to a higher level of understanding, right? The Buddha taught that we cannot be attached to anything. We have to abandon even our insights, our understanding, and our knowledge. I think this is bloody important. And this is one reason why I have no hesitation to study non-dual Shaiva Tantra, to learn from the Taoist tradition, to learn from the scientists and the physicists and the philosophers. I don't care. I get really a little bit edgy and nervous when I somehow feel like I've got this figured out, right? I've got mind figured out. I've got reality figured out. I get a little unsettled. And so I think what Thich Nhat Hanh says here is really beautiful and really important, because the minute you think you're done, it's called the myth of knowledge in Daniel Boorstein in his book, The Explorers, talk about it. He talks about it is paraphrasing. It's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you do know that just ain't so. What a great line. It's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you do know that just ain't so. So anyway, I think you get the idea. This is where the whole the gift of great postmodernism stuff comes into play. But this type of humility, I think, is really important, because otherwise, oh, my teacher, my tradition, my whatever, we've got all the answers. Yet, I don't think so. Anyway, that's my little rant on that. Okay. Hey, Candy. Fire away.
Am I unmuted? Yes. Hi.
Hi.
So, wow. I've been listening to Kenpo Sandrup Rinpoche do the Tibetan Book of the Dead over the past several weekends.
Yeah, wow.
From the Garchen Institute. And I've been listening to you for 2.5 years, and you're really, first of all, thank you so much for all of your teachings.
You should move on. It's time for you to move on. So many
I mean, you have changed my world, and
it's scary.
So then you know, it's pretty frightening listening to that stuff.
What's up, dear? What are you
talking about? Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Oh yeah, totally. It should be. Yeah.
And so I'm walking down the street with my dogs. They've been listening too. And I started to hear your voice saying, but it's not the me that I think I am that's going to experience those things, right?
Correct.
Well, then what is it? And how do you know? And do you know?
Oh, yeah, these are such great questions. Like, which one do you want me to focus on?
What is it?
What is it that experiences and what is it that knows? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay. So again, somewhat in line with the other questions, these are really beautiful, absolute level, non-dual questions, which are really difficult. And so I can give you the words for it. I can tell you what it is, but that may not have much impact. Fundamentally, it's the luminous empty nature of the mind knowing itself. I can give you the words. What fundamentally takes place is, there's so much to say here, is that what fundamentally knows is not candy, right? There's a dimension of your being, the Dharmakaya dimension deeper within you, that will simply fundamentally come to recognize itself. That's it. And so that's why you, the outer form, and again, we start with where we are. We start with Andrew. We start with Candy. We start with Meyer. We start with whatever we are. And we work and we work and we work. And we try and we struggle. We have to go through those machinations, that manual labor. But eventually what fundamentally happens, and this is the really good news, is you just release, relax, all that. And at that moment of relaxation and release, of course, archetypally represented in the ultimate moment of death, then basically what happens is awareness comes to know itself. It's literally rangre yeshe, clear light mind, whatever term you want to append to it. The inner dimension of your being, like water pouring back into water, or in the Tibetan Book of the Dead language, is mother and child luminosity, also known as Dharmakaya Poa, the mother and child reunion. The mother luminosity is the nature of the mind that you're going to experience at the moment of death. The child luminosity is the degree of recognition, realization that you're cultivating now in life. And so what happens is, and this is the really good news, is it doesn't take a great deal for a child to recognize its mother. There's this fundamental, deeply inextricable connectivity between mother and child. And so all the work that you're doing with the Bardo stuff, all the stuff that you're wrestling with, struggling with, you don't have to have a colossal, massive insight for this, for the child to grow up, so to speak, metaphorically, very rapidly at the moment of death, completely recognize its mother, embrace mother and child reunion. That's enlightenment in one life. But if you're not there, you know, ego can't attend its own funeral. You're not going to be there. You're gone. Gate, gate. But the who you really are, that doesn't enter the world of space. It cannot die. That just basically recognizes itself. But you don't have to wait till you don't have to wait till you die to have this. This is what deep meditation is about. This is what happens spontaneously every night in deep dreamless sleep. We go through this journey every effing night. We just don't recognize it. See? So fundamentally, that's what happens. Self-awareness, self-liberating, self-aware. It's just water dissolves into water, and who you really are fundamentally just recognizes itself. Okay? Something like that. I wish it was easier to put into words, but it's not, right?
I can feel what you're saying. I mean, I can't necessarily intellectualize it, but I feel it as you're saying it, which is why I resonate with you so much. I have one more quick question. I lost my dog last week, one of them.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, losing a pet is such a big hit. I'm so sorry. What's his or her name? His or her name?
It was Trinity, and I have Neo behind me right here, and he's suffering all the time.
Oh, that's so.
They were my matrix dogs. So, I mean, talk about the experience of the letting go when you're in the room with them. And so, any suggestions on what I can do for her now? Because she hangs out. I mean, I feel her.
Oh, totally. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, let's help Trinity a little bit. So here's what happens. Let me just talk a little bit more so-called abstractly, and then a little bit more concretely. So when Trinity dropped when Trinity dropped her dog suit, right? Her dog costume, she returned to the ultimate dressing room, which is where we're all going to go. The Candy costume is going to go away. The Andrew costume is going to strip down. The Trinity costume is going to be taken away. And I don't care what type of sentient being it is. We are all going to return to the fundamental same bed of mind. And so Trinity doesn't nearly suffer as much as we do. Trinity, for an animal like that, that doesn't have this painful sufferential process, death is just no big deal for them because they don't have that kind of cognitive reflexing going on. So the only people that really suffer are us. And why do we suffer? Because we're grasping. And again, I'm not saying, please understand. I'm not saying don't grieve. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that fundamentally what my teacher Kenpo Rinpoche talked about, so much easier said than done, is love without attachment. For Westerners, that's like almost a contradiction in terms. Like, what do you mean, love without attachment? Well, you can still have a completely open, broken heart, but you can do so without a stickiness. And so in terms of where Trinity is, Trinity is dissolved back into the nature of mind, the clear light mind, just like all of us, because she has the same nature of mind that we do. And then depending on what's happening with her karma, she's being recycled and we'll find some other costume or form to come in with. Maybe next time you guys are going to switch places. You never know, right? Like, that's a sweet little thought. You never know, right? So how you can help her? Well, you can keep her in your mind and heart. Every time you think of her, you can recite a mantra like Om Mani Padme Hum. At the end of every day, you can dedicate your merit to her. There is a lot you can do. And again, sorry for the promotion, but in my book, hey, what a surprise, it's all about me. There's a section in there about what to do with the loss of a pet and how to actually help them. You can, everything you do for a human being, you can do for a pet. And so there's a ton you can do. Dedicate merit, sir offering. I mean, just so many different things. But the most important thing really, Candy, simplest thing is whenever you think of her, just open your heart, think of her with love, and just release. And then eventually what you'll find, you know, she is probably in fact coming into your mind space, and you can kind of welcome her there, hold her there. So you even talk to her and you say, hey, wow, Trinity, guess what? You've transitioned. You're in this kind of intermediate space. How cool. You know, now you're about to start a new journey. I'll be joining you someday. Don't worry about it. We'll meet again. And then just create this atmosphere, this holding environment of love and light and release. And that's really by far the most important thing you can do, because that type of non-conceptual, heartfelt communication is what's really going to transmit. Because again, remember, the world is not made of matter. There's no time, there's no space. We have tremendous capacities to help these sentient beings, animal or otherwise. But that's one of the simplest, most effective ways. Every time you think of her, recite a mantra perhaps, or just open. And it's really, honestly, it's that simple. Okay. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, Myra, one more, and then we'll see if there's any after that, but fire away, dear.
Uh-oh, there it goes.
Yes, I know, I got it. I was not going to say much, but you again, before I take one of your seminars, my dreams get fantastic. And I prepare and meditate, asking for teachings. And you just came with something that shocked me. One of the things that happened after Menla at the end, it was so magical that all of a sudden I realized that I had to let it all go. I had to let go of Andrew Halachek. I had to let go of the experiences, the compliments, all the magic, all the forest. And then there was this overwhelming sweet sadness that came over me that has carried until now. So I was not even taking this next course because I think you have to step back. There's a big difference between letting go of that and running away because you're afraid of the experience. Nice. Or being afraid to step into something that you don't have control. Is that an accurate assessment of a process?
Yes, I think so. And again, you don't, the quality of letting go here, it's not like there has to be some kind of forceful release of this. Because that type of experience can very beautifully perfume your life, perfume your mind, because there's actually some contact with reality taking place here. You know, I love this notion that when you contact the nature of mind, reality, it registers as beauty in relationship to objects and love in relationship to beings. And so if you're having a perfume kind of continuity of the experience of love and beauty, I mean, letting go doesn't, what to say here, just simply abide in that. But the trick with the letting go part here is exactly, I think what you're working with is you don't want to get sticky to that. You don't want to like grab onto it and say, oh, if I'm not experiencing that, I'm out there. No, you know, fundamentally, you know this, Mara, that you have that experience. It's a wonderful nyam. You appreciate for what it is. And then if it happens to continue, so be it, svaha. You'll notice what keeps it alive when you get sticky. How will you notice that? Commentary. Mm-hmm. You're going to start spinning a discursive storyline. That's how you know. And so that experience that what Trungpa Rinpoche talked about is the ideal emotion, by the way, sad joy. That is when you're actually in contact with reality. You don't have to let that go. But do notice, however, and I'm sure you're doing this, that if you're starting to run a commentary on it, that's the sticky mind coming back in. That's what you let go of.
I had not commented until now because I didn't think I should have. And then you triggered, your comments triggered the retrieving of the experience.
But you know, the take home message here is self-liberate even the antidote. You know, you said, okay, letting go of me, please, dear, let go of me.
Okay.
Eventually, self-liberate the antidote. Let go of everything. That's, you know, they talk about it as the emptiness of emptiness. Don't attach to anything. I mean, nothing. Don't attach to emptiness. Don't attach to anything. That constant openness, flexibility, again, open and relax. Doesn't matter what it is. Because otherwise what happens, and this gets really, I've riffed on this a lot. If you start to get sticky around spiritual experiences, those are really dangerous traps. You have some beautiful experiencing, you know, your mind just almost can't help but attach to it. That can be somewhat problematic. And so sometimes when you're having these really great lofty experiences, you have to just, again, recognize what's happening and release even that. Because otherwise those spiritual experiences will backfire. The opportunities backfire and then they turn into obstacles, right? Anything can be turned into an obstacle, anything. When you reify it, stick to it, attach to it, anything. So that's why they say in Zen, if you meet the Buddha in the road, kill him.
Thank you.
Don't kill me.
Kill the Buddha, right? Okay. I'll try.
All right, maybe okay, one thanks. More.
Hello.
Hey, buddy.
Hi, Andrew. I would like to talk a little bit, if we may, about the human brain.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the West, we used to think that the human brain produced consciousness. And we now know it's the other way around.
Pretty much, yep.
Yeah. So apart from processing your senses, what does the human brain do? And especially when you start dying,
yeah,
and there are no more, electrical, no more electrical impulses.
Right.
Yeah. What exactly is happening with this brain?
Yeah. I chuckle because these are such huge questions, right?
I know.
really good ones. Okay, so here's one way to look at this, right? So what does a human brain do? What does any brain do? Well, it fundamentally acts as a reducing valve. And this is where the work of my dear friend Bernardo Castro comes really into play. You know, he talks about metabolism. This is so brilliant. He talks about biology metabolism, which includes the brain, as the external appearance of the dissociative process. And by this, what he means, and this is actually really, really interesting, is that if you were to actually experience, and this is the work of Carl Friston and others, if you were to actually experience reality in a completely unfiltered way, he basically says, and I love the language, and he said, you would fundamentally dissolve into an entropic soup. What a beautiful image, right? You know, it's just that the human apparatus is incapable of perceiving unfiltered mind at large. This is very interesting, agnostic conjecture. I think this is actually what might happen with rainbow body, with people who really open to that extent at the moment of death, they literally dissolve into light. So what the brain does is it filters, and read the book, if you want more about this, read the book by Tors Neurotronders called The User Illusion, Cutting Consciousness Down to Size. He puts all the numbers on this, which is really bloody interesting. How it is that we filter moment to moment, you know, like we perceive less than 1/10 trillionth of what's taking place. Think about that. 1/10 trillionth. And that 1/10 trillionth that comes through is that infinitesimal sliver that basically supports what we already hope and expect to see in reality. So basically the mind acts as this amazing reducing valve, which is why, interestingly enough, in experiences of opening, near-death experiences like Eben Alexander, pilots blacking out with G-force, blackouts with psychedelics, these sorts of things are not brought about by increase in brain activity, but with a reduction or even cessation of brain activity. I mean, it should be the other way around. If the materialists and brain scientists were right with their view that mind is an epiphenomena of matter and brain, it should be the other way around. We have opening experiences when the brain goes offline. So the brain fundamentally acts as a very sophisticated reducing valve. That reducing valve was opened at the moment of death. And then so the interesting question is, How are you going to relate to that openness, right? Do you have a mind and heart big enough to attain that? So I'll pause for just a second because you have more specific questions about brain itself, but I want to make sure at least I'm throwing something against the wall that might stick for you. Anywhere else you wanted me to run with this?
Well, if we're using only so little of the potentiality of the brain, then you start wondering what's the idea? Are human beings going to evolve more and more and more and more and more?
For sure. Oh yes, but they're not necessarily going to evolve with increased cognitive brain capacities. At least, I mean, this is all speculative, but it's very interesting, isn't it? When you look at how it is that even Hollywood producers and fiction writers typify more advanced alien human beings, right, or entities, isn't it always they have these massive heads and then these tiny little spindly bodies, right? I mean, like, really? So this is all pure conjecture. Like, what could really happen here? I think we're, Chardin has something interesting to say here about the evolution of consciousness. That fundamental, paraphrasing him, evolution hasn't ended. It hasn't stopped. It's just moved indoors. And so, again, who knows? It's way too early to say, because this, what we're experiencing is the human phenomenon is just a hiccup in the cosmos of evolutionary time. But it doesn't necessarily mean, at least I don't think so, that the Darwinian processes of biological evolution can out-contextualize everything else, right? I mean, I think evolution can take place irrespective of this kind of apparatus. But this is pure speculation. I'm just guessing here. So I, like you, I'm super interested in this sort of thing. I speak more as a dilettante than any authority on this topic. But I think there's really interesting traction here. Fundamentally, really the most important thing is mind is not reducible to brain. Mind is shrunk by brain. And so if we understand that, then yes, we pay homage to the correlations, not causations of this kind of intercourse. But realizing that mind, consciousness, whatever you want to call it, is so much bigger than this reducing valve and this shrink wrap phenomena. But if you haven't read Bernardo's stuff on this, he's got some really interesting things to say. And then I also recommend the book, The User Illusion. There's some really cool things on that. But
okay, last remark.
Okay.
It will be frightening to think that everything we are talking about, spirituality, everything, is just a trick of the mind of this brain.
There's no way. I can tell you what
this is, right? They told me this is not true, but
yeah. That's just hubris. I mean, that's just materialistic, physicalistic, reductionist arrogance. There's just no way. I mean, no way. So cool. Thank you, my friend. Hope that's just some help.
Okay, thank you.
So one last question, comment from Lloyd, and then we'll end for today. In one of Alberto Villalobos' books, he recounts that one of his mentors told him he should have 20% of his focus on himself, 20% on the community, and 60% on the cosmos. Okay. Does that statement have any meaning to you? Yeah. I mean, I'm curious about the math here, but I get the spirit. Here's the deal here. This is the way I relate to this. Is that, and this is where developmental theory really comes into play. Excuse me, that one constitutes development, one way to look at it is increased degrees of openness, decentralizing, right? And so basically one way, and they've done really interesting studies about this, one way to talk about evolution period is you go from egocentric to ethnocentric to cosmocentric. I mean, that's basically what he's saying here. The percentages, I guess, but fundamentally, this is, you know, another way, perhaps, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Vajrayana, each vehicle, everything's about opening, increasing rings, concentric circles getting bigger and bigger and bigger, connected to my favorite definition of meditation, habituation to openness, also connected to Tim's question, my answer, you know, irreducible restriction, open. But fundamentally, yeah, that's nice. Start with yourself. That's the Hinayana, 20%. I don't know about the math. Work with yourself. Yes, you have to start there. That dissolves. Then you open to relate more to your community. That's the more ethnocentric aspect, but even that's limited. And then eventually it becomes cosmocentric. You blow the doors on everything. And always remembering here that this particular opening is involves a narrative of transcend, but include. So even though you become fundamentally cosmocentric, which is in one way to say non-centric or acentricity, you always have recourse to behave in an ethnocentric way. In the transcend but include narrative, you can come back, work with your community, maintaining your cosmological perspective. You can come back, do your individual thing, the ego self. You know, ego is fundamentally not a problem, right? Ego is just a form of development. It's just arrested development. So I like this, but I would simply add from a developmental perspective, yes, fundamentally, you want to have 100% in the cosmos. You could also say, using the Trikaya thing, Dharmakaya. But then you come back intentionally, volitionally into these more concentric domains as a way to what? Relate to people who are still stuck at that level, right? So I like that. That's sweet. Something like that. That's what comes to mind. Okay. So, hey, thanks, everybody. Nice to be with you. Come join us with Menlo with Bob this weekend. If you've never experienced a weekend with Bob Thurman, you know this guy is amazing. I really love working with him. So I'm quite excited about that. But what we do here until we meet again is this little dedication of merit thing, if it means anything to you. If we've done anything of value, again, you got to let it go, baby. Release it. Any merit we've accumulated, we send to all beings. And we can send something very specifically into the heart mind of Trinity and Candy, our dear friends. They could use our help. Let's beam some oceans of merit into both of them and give Trinity a little bump into her next incarnation gig, right? And if you want to take your, unmute yourself and put your camera on, we do this little geeky group hug thing where we say, until next time, all the best, everybody. Great to see everybody.
Thank you. Ciao, ciao. Thank you. Bye. Thank you.